Deutsche Welle, Spotlight on Europe.
Hello and welcome to an exciting first edition of Spotlight on Europe in 2018. Happy New Year. From our studios in Bonn, Germany, my name is Wanjiko Mwaura. On today's program, can the German city of Frankfurt benefit from Brexit? And has Portugal's radical approach to drugs paid off?
Every family had its own drug addict. So it was so present in everyday life that it turned public opinion. Okay, we are dealing with a chronic relapsing disease, and this is a disease like the others. I do not put a diabetic in jail, for instance.
We also get a glimpse of Europe's last dictatorship. We start with the news. This week, we are looking ahead to some of the most important events that will be taking place in Europe in 2018. Here is Neil King with the details.
Russia's presidential elections on March 18th will, for the first time in 13 years, see a woman running for president. Ksenia Sobchak is a photogenic 36-year-old TV star and journalist who is campaigning on a pro-women platform and has described herself a candidate against all. She is well known in Russia thanks to an early reality TV career, which she subsequently swapped for journalism. As the daughter of Anatoly Sobchak, who was the former mayor of St. Petersburg and one of Putin's mentors, she has good political connections. But few in Russia believe she is truly attempting to take on Putin and is most likely just a political stooge of the Kremlin, chosen to add a bit of glamour and boost voter turnout. She has angrily denied claims that she's colluding with the Kremlin, stressing that she joined anti-government protests in 2011 and 2012. However, securing the 300,000 signatures in order to register is almost impossible without the backing of the Kremlin, which effectively ensures that Putin only has to deal with hand-picked and weak candidates. Russia's most popular opposition politician and anti-corruption activist, Alexei Navalny, wants to run in the 2018 presidential election too. But Russia's Central Election Commission has already declared him ineligible due to a suspended prison sentence, which he says was politically motivated. Given that most eligible candidates do not pose a serious threat, Putin, who has been in power since 2000 and currently enjoys approval ratings above 80%, is poised to win yet another election. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán is hoping to win a third consecutive term with his right-wing Fidesz party at parliamentary elections in April. In a vote that will likely be dominated by immigration, 54-year-old Orbán said voters would be deciding whether they wanted to remain a free nation, protecting their cultural heritage, or join those who are eroding Europe's traditional and Christian values by supporting immigration and integration. He added that unlike some other countries, Hungary didn't want immigration to solve its demographic problems of an ageing population and a looming labour shortage. Instead, he would focus on family-friendly policies to increase the population, push for higher wages and more money for pensioners. Orbán was one of the most vocal critics of German Chancellor Angela Merkel's open-door policy as the 2015-16 migration crisis reached its peak. And in September 2015, Hungary was the first EU country to physically bar refugees from entering its territory. Orbán's strict anti-refugee stance has put him at loggerheads with many EU leaders who want Hungary to share more of the burden. But it would appear his uncompromising attitude towards EU demands has done little to damage his prospects at the polls, with most analysts predicting Orbán's Fidesz party winning a firm lead over the fractured opposition parties. In 2018, Russia will become the first Eastern European country to host the Football World Cup. Players from 32 countries will be competing in 12 venues across 11 cities in three different time zones. The choice of Russia as a host country has been mired in controversy for various reasons. For one, football's governing body FIFA, itself no stranger to corruption, was forced to investigate claims of bribery in the voting process. It was discovered that Russia did not fully report all its contacts with the executive committee members, as required by the rules, but it was explicitly cleared of offering any excessive gifts or undue influence. Russian football fan culture has also come under severe criticism over hooliganism, homophobia and racist abuse of black players. Russia's FSB security service has reportedly cracked down hard on football gangs and blacklisted many of its leaders ahead of the World Cup. The authorities are also using fan ID cards and are forcing visitors and locals to undergo security checks before they can buy match or travel tickets. The aim is to avoid a repeat of the clashes during the European Cup in 2016, when Russian hooligans savagely beat up England fans inside Marseille Stadium. The opening match of the tournament will be played in Moscow on June 14th, with the final taking place a month later on July 15th. Europe's designated cultural capitals in 2018 are the Maltese capital Valletta and the Dutch town of Leeuwarden. At first sight, Valletta and Leeuwarden have little in common. One is located on a small, rocky and hilly Mediterranean island, and the other is the capital of the rather grassy and flat Friesland. But they do in fact share strong agricultural ties, exchanging potato crops and seeds twice a year. Maltese farmers use the Dutch seeds to grow potatoes, which are then shipped back to Leeuwarden. And it's this trade that gave the two cultural capitals the idea of launching a unique project, the so-called Poetry in Potato Bags project. For a period of 4 years, 8 Maltese and 8 Dutch poets will write poems that will be translated and exchanged with each shipment of potatoes in October and seeds in March. The idea is to form a conversation between the poets from both regions. Europe's Cultural Capital Initiative was launched in 1985 and comes with a year-long series of eye-catching cultural events that showcase the unique characteristics of the designated capitals.
Neil King with the news. This year, Britain will continue negotiations to cement its divorce from the EU. But several European cities have been salivating at the prospect of alluring international banks and other financial institutions away from London after Brexit. Frankfurt in Germany is the leading contender. It already hosts a medium-sized financial centre and is home to the European Central Bank, which supervises the euro. But while the benefits of gaining the extra business are obvious, not everyone in Frankfurt is putting out the welcome mat. Stephen Beard reports.
In a cosy little restaurant on the edge of the financial district, the young owner, Louise Höpfner, makes herself a cup of coffee and relaxes after the lunchtime rush. Louise is rather pleased with herself. She took a gamble opening her restaurant a year ago. Now she believes it'll pay off, thanks to Brexit.
I think for me it will increase the demand, actually. More people, more business, more money. The Brexit will be good for us.
No one knows for sure how many bankers will flee London after Brexit and how many will end up here. 10,000, say the Frankfurt authorities. Some say it could be 50,000. Two blocks away from Louise's restaurant, another local business is quietly gearing up for the influx.
Welcome to our Frankfurt office. I can show you here some interesting properties we currently are offering to our clients.
Olivier Peters owns the Sotheby's real estate franchise in this city, selling high-end properties to the very well-heeled.
This is now one of the most expensive properties we are currently offering. It's a beautiful villa for 4.9 million euros. That is for Frankfurt a very high price. You
know, cheap. By London standards, the same mansion in the British capital would cost three times as much, but Olivier says Frankfurt prices are rising.
We have sold some villas where we were of the opinion that this may be 10 to 15% overpriced, but we still got them sold quite quickly.
Because of Brexit?
We cannot answer for sure, but it went much quicker than before Brexit.
No sales yet to London-based bankers, but just the prospect of at least 10,000 rich newcomers arriving in the city appears to be pushing up prices. Deutsche Bank, whose twin towers I can see on the skyline, reckons that Frankfurt property overall is up 11% since the Brexit process began. And that's worrying some local residents.
People who live now in Frankfurt, they fear very strong that the prices will go up and up here and they have no chance anymore to live in Frankfurt here.
Festus Meyer, a middle-aged office worker, says there's already an acute housing shortage here. Frankfurters of modest means will be forced out of this city and it'll become more exclusive.
It will change the atmosphere, it will change here some parts of the city of Frankfurt here. And the gentrification here will start.
Gentrification.
The gentrification, yeah. They don't like it too much, the public here. Yeah.
And here's his vision of hell. This broad avenue in the centre of Frankfurt, Europa Allee, is a likely destination for the incomers. Luxury apartment blocks and shops have been springing up here for more than 5 years. Several hundred people already live here, but it doesn't look or feel like a community. Tobias Schmitz of local housing campaign group MHM.
We don't see many people around here. It's pretty grey and it's sterile. No life at all. It's dead. It's like a ghost town.
He claims the financial workers who live here only use the place to crash at the end of the day. They have no interest in putting down roots.
It's a very fast business. People want to make money in a few years and then move somewhere else. Politicians seem to be focused on the chances that arise by Brexit, the opportunities, but we also see risks. Risks for the inhabitants of Frankfurt.
He'd prefer the Brexit bankers went to Paris instead. But on the other side of town, not far from the European Central Bank, I met two students, Robin Ladvig and Saman Danadeh, would be happy to see the fleeing bankers rolling into town.
With more bankers coming in, there will be higher income of taxes. That will also improve not only Frankfurt, but the whole region.
My comment on all the bankers is come over here, you're welcome.
The more the merrier.
Yeah, the more the merrier, yeah.
It must be said, the subject those two students are studying is finance. Stephen Beard, DW, Frankfurt.
Seventeen years ago, Portugal introduced a radical approach to tackle drug abuse. It decriminalized all of them. Back in the 1980s and 90s, the country had one of the worst heroin epidemics in the world. But since 2001, possession or use of any drug, even heroin, has been treated as a health issue, not a crime. From Lisbon, Lauren Freya reports on how successful this strategy has been.
Gandalina Damião is a living relic from Portugal's poor, troubled past. At 78, she can't read or write. She still lives in the same Lisbon slum where she gave birth to 9 children, all at home. Gandalina made a living ironing clothes for better-off families. She struggled and suffered an unimaginable loss. 3 of her children died from heroin in the 1990s.
That's a picture of my son who died of drugs. He was 25. And that's a picture of another of my sons who died from drugs at 33. And that's my little girl there. She was just 20 when she died.
She points to framed photos of Paulo, Miguel and Liliana on the wall of her cottage on a cobblestone street with views of Lisbon's Tejo River. She recalls how her street was once littered with syringes and how she had to search through abandoned, graffitied buildings looking for her children when they were high or in withdrawal.
It was a huge blow. I was a good mother. I did everything I could. I never gave them money for drugs, but I couldn't save them.
For much of the 20th century, Portugal was a closed Catholic society with a military dictator and no drug education. In the 1970s, young men were drafted to fight wars in Portugal's African colonies, where many were exposed to drugs for the first time. Some came home addicted. says João Goulao, Portugal's drug czar.
This is a little bit like the Americans in Vietnam. Whiskey was cheaper than water, and cannabis, which was very easy to access down there.
So people came home from war addicted?
Yes, addicted, or at least with some habits of using.
Then there was a revolution in 1974, the end of authoritarian rule in Portugal.
So suddenly everything was different. Freedom came, a lot of changes in our society. And drugs were something that came with freedom. But we were completely naive about drugs.
By the 1990s, 1% of Portugal's population was hooked on heroin. It was one of the worst drug epidemics in the world, and it prompted Portugal's government to take what was, at the time, a very different approach. It decriminalized all drugs. Starting in 2001, possession or use of any drug, even heroin, has been treated as a health issue, not a crime. Goulao had worked as a family physician at the height of the epidemic. He says there was very little opposition to the policy change.
Every family had its own drug addict. So it was so present in everyday life that it turned public opinion. Okay, we are dealing with a chronic relapsing disease, and this is a disease like the others. I do not put a diabetic in jail, for instance.
Goulao wrote the 2001 law that decriminalized all drugs. Drug dealers still go to jail, but anyone caught with a less than 10-day supply of any drug gets mandatory medical treatment. No judge, no courtroom, no jail. Instead, they end up here, a sparsely furnished, discreet, unmarked office in downtown Lisbon for counseling with sociologists like Nuno Cabage.
If people are nervous when they are coming in, after the preliminary interview, they are much more calmer because we avoid all sort of morality involved in these sorts of situations. We are very cold and straightforward about what might be the consequences of the risks. And basically, we try to empower people with the knowledge to enable them to make a decision if they want to keep using or not that illicit substance that they are using.
His team of 10 counselors handle all of Lisbon's roughly 2,500 drug cases a year. In case that sounds like a lot, it's a 75% drop in the capital since the 1990s.
It's cheaper to treat people than to incarcerate them. If I come across someone that wants my help, I'm in a much better position to provide it than a judge would ever be. And just as simple as that.
Hugo Faria is a psychologist who runs a government-supported drug treatment clinic on wheels. He drives around in a van administering methadone, an opioid that helps wean people off heroin. Faria knows all the areas in Lisbon where addicts gather to buy and consume drugs. And he takes me to meet some of his regular clients, including a 48-year-old man named Rui.
The heroin is a bad stage to the health. When you feel bad, you must consume again. I'm treated with the methadone in the van. Now I'm treating heroin problem with methadone in the van.
It's a smoking place. Because it's different, the smoking area and the injection area, they divide this because they divide each other, the smoking heroin users and the injectors. Yes.
He may be treating his heroin problem, but as we chat, Rui pulls out a pipe and starts smoking crack cocaine. That may be frustrating to those trying to help him, trying to get him to stop doing drugs altogether. But it's a step toward harm reduction. He no longer shoots up. Faria and fellow psychologist Raquel Gloria hand Rui a drug safety kit.
What is this? It's the kit where you put where we give the syringes, the water, the recipient, the filter for them to use our heroin or cocaine.
so that when Rui smokes crack, which still carries risks to himself and society, at least he uses his own filters, so he won't pick up infections from cracked lips or saliva on shared drug paraphernalia. The kit also contains condoms to prevent the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. The methadone van does testing for HIV, hepatitis, even pregnancy. Since the start of such programs in Portugal, drug-related HIV infections have dropped 95%. Drug counselors are familiar faces in this slum. The hope is that with such daily contact, addicts won't resort to crime and are more likely to enter treatment, says Faria, who's done this work for 12 years.
They are people like us. They are normal people. And they are always surprising us when they do things that like people do. We expect different things, but they are simple humans.
For every person in Portugal who cannot escape addiction, there's daily methadone, counseling, and free treatment. A generation ago, these addicts were put in jail. And now they're on the street, with all the risks to society that might entail. But polls show the Portuguese, having lived through the ravages of a heroin epidemic, overwhelmingly support this policy. Lauren Freyer, DW, Lisbon.
If you're just joining us, this is Spotlight on Europe with me, Wanjiku Moura. Now, from Portugal, we head over to Belarus. It is often described as Europe's last dictatorship. It's an isolated country that still takes its lead from the old Soviet Union and relatively few people visit it. But last year, its authoritarian government under the leadership of Alexander Lukashenko decided to make it possible for EU passport holders and some other nationalities to enter the country for 5 days visa-free. And it's now considering extending that to 10 days. You can only travel within certain parts of Belarus. But our correspondent Julian Berner took advantage of the visa-free deal to find out more.
A disturbing sight greets you as you arrive in Belarus at the end of a 5.5-hour train ride from central Poland. When the train pulls in at the modern Hrodna station, you notice a makeshift fence around the railway platform with policemen watching you as you make your way toward passport and customs control. For an East European, the long queues and the serious faces of those inspecting your passport and asking questions about your travel plans give you an impression of going back in time. On a public bus to the freshly renovated and brightly coloured Hrodna Old Town, a female conductor wears a uniform again reminiscent of the old USSR. But the ticket's printed out from a portable device which accepts credit cards. After all, Belarus prides itself on being one of the most IT-advanced countries in the region. Everybody on the bus carries a smartphone, even the elderly. The city's historic castle is perched on the high bank of the Niemen River. As Hrodna guide Ihor explains, over the centuries, the city was fought over by neighboring Lithuania, Poland and Russia, which ruled over Belarus in succession. Before World War II, it had a large Jewish population.
Hrodna is a historic city where tradition is very important, where the cultures of Belarus, Poland, Lithuania, Russia, and Jewish culture blend to make up something unique. Here lie our roots. Hrodna is a city of museums. I love my city.
More and more travelers from the EU, like 29-year-old Patrick from Dublin, are coming to Western Belarus to experience this once isolated place. He says he's explored everything there is to see within the 30-kilometer radius that he was allowed to visit within the allotted period.
It is a bit different, say, to Ukraine, Russia. It was very clean. Things were very well organized in terms of infrastructure. Everything was orderly. It was quite pleasant to be there, not very stressful. And people are actually a good bit more respectful towards each other than I've seen in the other countries in the region.
Щоб наші діти нарешті почали народжатися з орліними носами, а не з кирпатими і пляскатими. Насипать гори, насипать.
But Belarus also has a darker side. These angry lyrics of a Belarusian rock song reflect the opposition's yearning for freedom denied by President Lukashenko, the country's autocratic ruler of the past two decades. You can hear it playing from MP3 players inside some taxis and on an independent radio station broadcasting into Hrodno from Poland, 40 kilometers away. But you won't hear it on local stations. Instead, popsa, Russian dance music, is promoted by the Belarusian authorities, who do their best to foster brotherly relations with Moscow. Due to years of Sovietization, 80% of the population now speak Russian instead of the local Belarusian. It is similar, but not quite the same. The authorities pay lip service to it by using it on road signs and public address boards. The occasional TV weather forecast is also in Belarusian. The rest is in Russian. But the old language is still spoken in parts of the countryside and in democratic opposition circles. As Irishman Patrick explains, trying to decide in which language to address a stranger, even to say hello, can be quite stressful.
They actually have two official languages, one being Russian, of course, which is spoken everywhere by everybody, and then Belarusian, which is spoken by minority in the country, even though the country is called Belarus. And I saw it written everywhere, actually in all the buses, signposts, and it's very similar to Ukrainian, especially the alphabet they use.
Inside this modern shopping mall, in a country where the average monthly wage is just 200 euros, the prices are higher than in neighboring Lithuania and Poland, except for bottles of vodka and packs of cigarettes. But you're only allowed one of each in your luggage. According to local officials, there are many more benefits to cross-border traffic than this. Vladimir Kravtsov is the head of the Hrodno Executive Council.
The decision to allow visa-free travel was taken at the highest level in Minsk. It's restricted to a zone around our city, but we're hoping for more such openings. They'll mean more business opportunities and more revenue from tourism. This is quite new to us.
Sitting on a bus back to Poland, Polish university student Tomek, a first-time visitor, is keen to share his impressions of Belarus, which to him used to be one of the most mysterious places in Europe. He met young people like him. They are very open. They are keen to find out what life in the EU is really like, he says. Our languages are similar, so we can communicate easily. Talking to us, they are bound to see the world differently, Tomek hopes. For now, the majority of Belarusians continue to vote for President Lukashenko, who they say makes them feel safe. Yet unlike the citizens of conflict-torn Ukraine next door, who can travel to the EU visa-free, they still need to pay through the nose for an EU visa, while they are free to visit and work in Russia. There are those in neighboring Poland and Lithuania who think that change in Belarus won't come about until a free flow of people happens on a broader scale. For now, EU nationals can take a peek at some places in Belarus and possibly have a brief chat with the locals. Julian Berner, DW. Hrodno in Western Belarus.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Spotlight on Europe. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We would love to connect with you on our Facebook page, DW Africa, or you can also write to us an email via feedback.africa@dw.com. Thanks to the rest of the team, Eliane Giladucci, Helen Sini, Emma Wallace, Susan Hilton, and our technician Christoph Grove, and thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week with another edition of Spotlight on Europe. I'm Wanji Komwaura, and from all of us here at DW, have a wonderful time. Oh,
but then, my sweetie, back then, when I look into your eyes, I go insane.